Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This show is a public service of people to people, a not-for-profit 501c3 registered Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. Our topic for this evening focuses on medical training in Ethiopia, establishing new residency programs and international collaborations and partnerships between institutions of higher learning. The number of medical schools in Ethiopia has increased exponentially over the last decade. Until recently, Ethiopia had just one physician for over 100,000 people. There has been significant improvement in this ratio, but the distribution of physicians across the country and urban and rural centers remains very uneven. The number of medical students enrolled this year is almost tenfold more than the number just a few years ago. The strong emphasis on health personnel numbers naturally brings about a discussion and concern for quality. With limited overall resources and qualified faculty, creative approaches to mitigate these shortages become critical. Fostering partnerships with international institutions of higher learning and leveraging technology to augment bedside teaching are important components of this equation. My guests this evening have been engaged in establishing this kind of international partnerships, developing and supporting medical training programs in resource-constrained countries, and strengthening healthcare delivery systems for many years. Dr. Otto Koster is a senior fellow at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, where he's responsible for program development and grant acquisition related to international education, research, and professional exchanges, and for liaison with donor organizations and scholarly organizations in the U.S. and abroad. He previously held positions at Princeton University and the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, was assistant director of Salzburg Global Seminar, and worked as a program officer at United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, Dr. Koster.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Dr. Nancy Fitch is a family medicine specialist and an expert in international and domestic primary health service delivery with many years of experience both in the U.S. and a number of other countries. Her technical expertise is in family medicine and primary care service delivery, HIV/AIDS, maternal child health, quality improvement, performance-based financing, and health system strengthening. Dr. Fitch has worked with the University of Montana, USAID, and the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation in various capacities, including consultant, technical advisor, and country director. She is currently a consultant to the University of Montana in assisting the College of Medicine and Health Sciences at the University of Gondar in its efforts to create a family medicine residency program for Ethiopia. Great to have you with us this evening, Dr. Fitch.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
So if I may begin with you, Dr. Fitch, and to start us off on our discussion this evening, what does the training of a family medicine physician entail?
Thank you. It's a good question. A family medicine specialty is a cross-cutting specialty and a bit different than many other specialties. Other specialties such as OBGYN or pediatrics focus on a certain organ system or a certain age of patients. Family medicine was actually developed to respond to patient needs in primary health care settings. And so family doctors study a range of clinical areas, including pediatrics, OBGYN, internal medicine, trauma, mental health, as well as health administration, service delivery, quality improvement, with the goal of acquiring the skills needed to provide, to provide quality services, quality health care, generally to an outpatient population in a primary care setting. So usually one of the, to support the first point of contact. So it's a combination of skill sets. A family doctor certainly doesn't know the same depths of pediatrics as a pediatrician, but the part they should know would be outpatient diseases or common diseases based upon whatever the disease profile is in a certain place or country.
All right, thank you. So the role of a family medicine physician, as you said, is across all spectrums of the primary medicine specialties.
They usually have training in common areas such as pediatrics, internal medicine, OBGYN, and the subset of those areas would be what are the most common conditions encountered in a primary care setting? What do 80% of patient needs include?
Okay. So you've helped set up family medicine training programs in different countries, including Armenia and Rwanda. So how does that experience compare with your current efforts with Gondar University?
It's a very good question. You know, every country is completely unique, and every country's health system depends very much on how that country has developed. In Armenia was part of the former Soviet Union, and I was there in 2001 to 2004, about 10 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had a very fairly rigidly defined medical model of how services were delivered. They had polyclinics of different size and shape, and every part of the former Soviet Union had these same polyclinics. They also had a host of specialists, some 90 different types of specialists. And an example of how extreme that was that a child who wanted to go to kindergarten had to see 14 different doctors to get their form.
Wow.
So it was, in some sense, the opposite of where Africa is. It had a surplus of different specialties, and family medicine was actually funded by the World Bank and supported by USAID to make a little more sense out of all the different specialties. So that's sort of an opposite extreme. But Armenia, at that point when I was there, had two family medicine training programs at two of its state universities, but they weren't really meeting the needs, in part because they were set up by specialists in these different areas who weren't family doctors. So the training that they were being given was sort of like a part pediatrician, a part internist, without this understanding philosophy and approach of how do you provide comprehensive, coordinated, and continuing care to patients in whatever setting they're in. So we rewrote the curriculum. We restructured their different clinical rotations. We redesigned their reference materials to help make sure that the residency program met the needs to and met the goal of the whole purpose, which was to have patients be able to get care at their point of service, comprehensive care at their point of service.
Okay. And then your experience in Rwanda was completely different than that.
Yes, it was in some ways the opposite. Rwanda, of course, had a terrible genocide in 1994, and the healthcare system was completely devastated. And I was there 20 years later. And at that point, Rwanda only, it's a small country. It's a country that's made incredible progress. It only had one medical undergraduate, one medical faculty, one training institute. It had no postgraduate training programs, and family medicine was their first postgraduate training program. And it always takes a bit of negotiation because traditional specialists often feel displaced by family doctors, although I think in reality traditional specialists are not best used in outpatient settings in health centers and health posts. So I don't think there truly is competition, but it always takes some negotiation and understanding before a before the health system as a whole and the Ministry of Health can embrace family medicine. So they were at the stage of still trying to understand it. I was working for USAID at that time, and I helped get funding approved to start this program, and I was there for their first or second year. A lot of that was really about what are we training, what should family doctors be able to do? So it was in developing agreeing on clinical competencies. A lot of it was agreeing on what the role of the family doctor would be in the national health system. So what level of the healthcare system would they work at? Did it make sense to place family doctors in district hospitals or in health centers? The country had a profound shortage of physicians overall. There was a desire to have, you know, some key surgical specialties. So how would why would you allocate resources to fund family doctors in outpatient settings when there were no cancer doctors in the countries, for example? So it was very much at an early stage of setting up a family medicine program.
Okay. Dr. Costa, you've been traveling to Ethiopia and have been involved in various activities for quite some time. If you could share with our audience how you first got interested in Ethiopia and describe some of the activities you've been involved in.
Yes. I first became involved with Ethiopia in the late 1960s in the European calendar. That was still at the time of Haile Selassie when I was a Peace Corps volunteer, and I was stationed in Debre Berhan, and I was a secondary school teacher at Haile Mariam Mamo School. And it was a very valuable time for me, and I learned Amharic and got to know many people that I became friends with. And then when I came back to the United States, for many years, I didn't have much contact with Ethiopia until about 7 or 8 years ago, when I was invited by Addis Ababa University to come and do some workshops for their administrators and for their faculty in developing proposals for new programs and for purposes of seeking funding from outside donor organizations, or what one calls project development and grant writing. And I did some workshops at the university there for about a week. And also at that time, we established a memorandum of understanding between the University of Montana, which is where I am now, and Addis Ababa University, and we have had some exchanges of faculty, of Addis Ababa University faculty that have come to the University of Montana. Most importantly, the longest time that I spent in Ethiopia was then at the University of Gondar for 4 months together with my wife. We were both invited. She is a psychologist. She was invited by the psychology department at the University of Gondar, and I was invited to come and to do some training and workshops and to help them actually to try to identify and some funding and to develop and work with faculty members to write some grant proposals to seek funding initially for the University of Gondar. It was planning, and it still is planning, in the process of expanding and improving its postgraduate programs in mental health, but then also then more recently was asked to become involved when the University of Gondar was notified that the Ministry of Health is mandating the creation of a family medicine residence program at the University of Gondar. So that's how I also became involved then with questions of family medicine and how to plan such a program and how such a program might be funded from external sources.
Yeah, that's great. So what would you say are the essential aspects of fostering these partnerships between international institutions, especially between developing and developed countries?
Yeah, I think the essential piece is understanding is for the developing countries or people from developing countries, universities, to really listen quite carefully, to get from the developing country and from that university an understanding of what the real needs are that they have at this point in time. I've seen a lot of times when there are high-level university delegations that come to visit the United States or high-level American universities, administrators going to developing countries to seek partnerships with those universities, and they sign memorandum of understanding very quickly. But all too often, if faculty are not involved and if there isn't specific discussion among faculty members in different departments about what their real needs are and what kinds of assistance they need and how to implement it, if that doesn't happen, that communication at the faculty and at the department level, all too often those memorandum of understandings just simply remain pieces of paper of agreement that ultimately do not have much follow-up or consequence. And so I think the really important part is communication starting at the level of where it's the faculty and the researchers speaking to each other. They best understand what the immediate needs are in their particular areas and how often university faculty from the developed world, how they can go send their students and themselves, say, do research or teach in those other countries, in the developing countries, and that they get a much better understanding of how what higher education and the needs are in a different culture, in a different society other than their own. It's really a problem to go in with preconceived notions of saying, look, Ethiopia, this is what you need, without really having a firm understanding of what, in fact, the needs and the interests and the commitments and the capacities on the other side are, in order to develop a plan whereby over the long term there can be exchanges that are mutually beneficial.
Okay, so the relationship and discussion should not only just be between institutions, but with actual human beings, personal relationships fostered in between departments and peers and counterparts from both sides.
That's right.
Okay, all right. So coming back to the family medicine residency program in Gondar, Dr. Fitch, what is the timeline? Where is it at right now?
It's very... from our side, from what we have proposed, we helped University of Gondar submit a concept paper for funding to USAID. And a large part of our involvement is contingent upon obtaining funding. However, in the meantime, Gondar is moving ahead per directives from the Ministry of Health. I believe they're in a phase of recruiting faculty and developing rotations, and I think they anticipate the first cohort of trainees to start this January. So they're under the gun. They're moving along rapidly. They have identified some of their own internal staff, but I think some of the basic building blocks, even such as, you know, available budget and how to structure the program, are being determined right now.
Okay. And I know that the first family medicine residency program was started at Addis Ababa University in 2013, and they're slated to graduate their candidates in 2016. Are you familiar with the program? Are there any collaborations or experience exchange that you're aware of, whether either it's between Gondar and Addis or between the international counterparts?
We have communicated with the University of Wisconsin and Toronto who helped support Addis Ababa program. It's preliminary communication. They have done a huge amount of work and did an excellent job in really laying the foundation for family medicine training in Ethiopia by developing the first curriculum. I think we would see the next steps to build on that, what would be stage two or stage three. I think usually in the second stage of setting up family medicine, you really need to get practical and concrete about what is the actual position that family doctors will have within the Ethiopian healthcare system. Where will they practice? What will they be responsible for? What levels of care will they be overseeing? How do they work with other providers? And I one of the developments we think that Gondar could have would be to have an active relationship with the Amhara Regional Bureau, Health Bureau, to add a lot of practical components based upon exactly what position these family physicians would have within the healthcare system. So I think there's been huge progress done with the Addis Ababa program. We hope that we could use funding that we received to bring together the various family practice programs on a regular basis so that they all have the benefit of learning from each other's experience and they're all going somewhat in the same direction as well so that any benefit is shared.
Okay. And then as you design the curriculum, what do you see as important differences in the training program in a developed country as compared to a developing country?
It would be totally different, I think. I think when you look at what the family physicians in the U.S. do and what doctors in the U.S. do on a daily basis is quite different than what doctors in Ethiopia do. And I think it first and foremost starts with the needs of the patients. So what are the disease profiles? What are the conditions that need treating? So the clinical content itself would be somewhat different. The unifying themes would be, you know, what are the health needs of the population? What are 80% of the health needs of the population? From a population's perspective, not on what a hospital treats, but if you go to the communities and the rural areas and say, what is the disease profile, what are the disease burdens there, and then say the family doctor should be there to actively support the health medical officers and the nurses that are working in health centers, and even if there are health extension worker issues, quality of care issues, what is the role of a family physician to support these other cadres at that point? How do they help the whole decentralized primary healthcare system improve quality of care? So I think the starting point is what are the health conditions in Ethiopia that the population needs treated, and then the principles of family medicine say, you know, design the curriculum around that. How do you provide definitive care? How do you maximize definitive care at a rural location so that patients don't have to travel to cities, can get the care they need right there? So there was a needs assessment done when the Addis Ababa curriculum was developed. My understanding is that was based upon a survey of practicing general practitioners. I would think the next step is to say what is their job in the Warda health system and what are the things they need to learn to support the peripheral health systems to function well. So the approach may be somewhat the same, but the content may be quite different.
Right. And then when I had a discussion with Dr. Hack with the University of Wisconsin, one of the things they were trying to align this family medicine physicians with was the thousands of health workers who have been trained in Ethiopia and now go door to door in every village and serve as the initial contact to the healthcare system. So one of the, I think, opportunities and challenges will be aligning these so that there will be a smooth flow of referrals and training and working together from that aspect.
Absolutely. I'm an outsider. I'm not an expert in Ethiopia, but, you know, the improvements that Ethiopia has made in their health service delivery and in improving the health of the population in the last 20 years has been very impressive. So the country has made huge advances. Nonetheless, there are still some fairly identified gaps and weaknesses in the quality of care offered by the health extension workers. So I would think, you know, starting with identified problems, working as a team, how do you identify solutions, that process of quality improvement should certainly engage the health extension workers.
Okay, all right. And coming back to you, Dr. Koester, we, you know, all realize that, you know, most of these ambitious programs also depend a lot on funding and obtaining grants, et cetera. And you've done workshops in that in Ethiopia. How well was that received, and what do you feel needs to be done in that respect?
Well, I felt that the workshops were very well received, both what I did at Addis Ababa University at the University of Konda. I think the biggest need is for Ethiopian universities, both faculty members and their graduate students, to become familiar with what it takes to obtain external funding. And how do you persuade either an international donor from a foundation or a government agency, how do you persuade them to provide the funding for what you think is a really useful and important project? And that's something which is very different from it takes skills to put together a persuasive funding proposal, first of all, to develop a plan which states objectives, which states what is the research plan or the design, what is going to be implemented, how is the project going to be evaluated, and what are some of the follow-up activities that are going to take place, how sustainable is the project going to be. All of those kinds of questions need to be carefully described and identified and articulated in funding proposals that donor organizations request. And that kind of document, and to try to be persuasive for external donors, that's not something that many people, at least in Ethiopia or in developing countries, are familiar with. I was, for example, one of the first questions that I'd ask in these workshops is, okay, well, what are some funding sources, international donors or so forth, that might have an interest in funding the particular project, say, that Addis Ababa University has in mind or that the University of Gondar does? And virtually nobody knows, and they didn't know how to even access that information on the Internet, because they hadn't been taught that. It hadn't been expected. You know, that's quite different from, example, the training that graduate students get in the United States, where if they're going to pursue a research or academic career, they're going to be held responsible for obtaining grants and external funding. And those kinds of skills and those kinds of practices for how to develop a proposal and to write a persuasive document are already taught in some of the graduate school courses. So I would say that it would be very useful for administrators and for postgraduate students in Ethiopia also to begin to understand that if they want to start something new or different, that they can't rely just strictly on the Ministry of Health or on the government or on the university's traditional budgets, but that they have to take the initiative to approach additional funding sources to find out what they are and to develop such proposals that could be submitted for funding consideration. I don't know if that makes sense.
It does. So as it stands now, this is not part of the curriculum in graduate training in Ethiopia that you're aware of.
That's correct. In fact, I was very, I have to say, pleased when I got to University of Gondar in January of this year for this four-month period. The dean of the school of the College of Arts and Sciences, he greeted me and he said, "Oh, I remember you from the training at Addis Ababa University several years ago, and I would like to let you know that I, in fact, was successful in obtaining a grant or two." I don't want to mention that as that I'm particularly good at this, but just to say that here is an example of someone who learned those skills and how important that has been for creating some new programs at the University of Gondar.
Great. We're almost halfway through our program, and I would like to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum, a public service by people to people. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, and my guests this evening are Dr. Nancy Fitch, who's a family medicine specialist and an expert in international and domestic primary health service delivery. She's currently a consultant to the University of Montana and working with the University of Gondar in establishing a family medicine residency program. Dr. Fitch has worked in many developing countries, including Cyprus, Rwanda, Mozambique, Ivory Coast, Swaziland, Lesotho, Liberia, Pakistan, Tanzania, Haiti, Uganda, and now Ethiopia. She specializes in quality improvement, performance-based financing, and health system strengthening. Also with us this evening is Dr. Otto Koster, who is a senior fellow at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center at the University of Montana. Dr. Koster has given guest presentations and led workshops on negotiation, conflict management, and grant writing at universities in Europe, Asia, and Africa, including Addis Ababa University, University of Gondar, and W. Marcos University. He first traveled to Ethiopia as a Peace Corps volunteer in the 1960s, and earlier this year, he and his wife, Dr. Lynn Samford Koster, a developmental psychologist, spent 4 months in Ethiopia as international experts at the invitation of the University of Gondar. We welcome your active participation. You can ask your questions or share your comments by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 1 if you'd like to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. So, Dr. Fitch, before we open up the lines, there are a lot of seasoned general practitioners in Ethiopia who, for one reason or another, did not go through formal residency training program. A good portion of these physicians usually serve as the sole practitioners in remote settings. They perform surgeries, deliver babies, etc., and in essence, function as family medicine practitioners. What do you think about setting up a mechanism whereby these folks can have an accelerated path or sit for an equivalency exam to be recognized as specialists, something like the grandfathering process here in the United States?
I think these rural practitioners would be ideal candidates for some sort of accelerated program. I think we would need to know what are the skills they want to or need to acquire. And I think a challenge that is not finalized, but I understand some progress has been made, is what role will these new physicians or these current GPs, what will be their place within the civil service cadre for the Ministry of Health? Will they be considered specialists and get a higher salary if they get advanced training? And I think we would also then need to assess what are they getting out of the advanced training? Is the quality of care they're actually providing improved, or is the scope of practice larger? So I think it makes total sense to think of some accelerated process for them, but there's some specifics that need to be defined to do that.
Okay. Let me open up the lines. I'm going to take the first call from area code 203-623. Go ahead, please.
Hello, am I on the line?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Oh, okay, fantastic. I have a question this evening for Dr. Fitch. As you are involved in domestic primary health service delivery, my question is about the vehicle for health information delivery. If you look at the financial sector as an example, mobile phones have reshaped consumer banking in developing nations. So are you planning to integrate mobile phones as a health information delivery mechanism? And if so, Do you see it as a tool to get information out, or do you think it would be used as a device to do more by engaging the patient to get some like screening questions or monitoring status?
I think mobile health is a really interesting field that's gotten a whole lot of excitement and attention because you can overcome a whole lot of communication barriers with, you know, text messages. The challenge is that I'm aware of in mHealth is it's gotten a lot of donor money and those projects have gotten success, but how and where is it owned by the national health system and who takes responsibility for it? What level of the health system is responsible for making sure that the messages are updated and things like that. So it's not a question of does it work, it's a question of how do you institutionalize it. It would be really exciting to include some of that. That said, it'd be really exciting to include some of that as part of basically this reform that we're proposing or that the ministry is proposing really for how to strengthen the primary healthcare system. I think it'd be absolutely terrific to look at how do you improve, you know, antenatal care by sending text messages to pregnant women, reminding them of visits or reminding them to plan their delivery. I think the potential is enormous, but who does what is the hard part here. Does that make sense?
Caller, are you still on the line?
Yes, I'm still there. Thank you. Yes, it makes a lot of sense.
All right. Okay, thank you. I'll take the next call from area code 703-625. Go ahead, please.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually, my question is in the same line. So I know you said mobile health would be a challenge in terms of institutionalizing it, but what do you see the role of technology and also the role of the diaspora physicians in teaching family medicine or medicine or other subjects in general in developing countries?
The role of technology, I mean, Africa is being revolutionized by technology, certainly the cell phone. And that does a huge amount. Certainly any strengthening of communication with rural areas is fundamental to good healthcare. On the other hand, building roads and getting water and electricity tends to be harder than cell phones sometimes. So I think development, I think improving healthcare in Ethiopia and in many countries is often a question of development too, because until you can, I mean, you can improve a whole lot with technological innovations and do point of care improvements, and that's huge. But without roads, and electricity, you sometimes, you know, are limited. So those are bottlenecks. In terms of the role for the Ethiopian physician, the Ethiopian diasporan physician, I think the potential is enormous. I think we will need that there will be certain skill sets that can be supported by either Ethiopian family physicians in the U.S. or some primary care specialists. They will need to be based upon the needs in country. So what does Gondar University need? What does Amhara Regional Health Bureau need? And we'll have to help those entities think that out and then see if there's opportunity for Ethiopian diasporan physicians to help that. But obviously you would come knowing the language and the culture, and that's enormous. So the potential is great. I think we have to figure out how to get there.
Can I add to that and say that it seems to me that an organization like People to People would be ideal in playing a role in helping to figure out exactly how and when and where the diaspora visits and workshops and trainings would be really worthwhile and effective?
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, you know, People to People is, of course, you know, actively involved in this and been promoting the concept of triangular partnership, a model where diaspora professionals can function as a bridge between Western institutions and those in their countries of origin. And as you both mentioned, yeah, diaspora professionals tend to be you know, culturally and linguistically competent, and they have established networks and enduring commitment. So that certainly will bolster, as you both said, you know, those efforts. I have an email question that says, you know, why Gondar was picked, or whether there is a plan to expand this to other universities.
The reason Gondar was picked is because the Ministry of Health designated three universities that would be asked to establish the family medicine programs. One of them was Jima, the other one was University of Sodo, and then the Gondar University. And once the ministry approached the University of Gondar, the University of Gondar approached the University of Montana, which has a family residence program, which was just recently established, asking them for technical assistance to develop their program. That's what the history of it is.
Okay. All righty. And I'll take the next call from area code 203-623. Go ahead, please.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Antenna, for the fabulous program. Continue to dive now into the tech arena. I love this a lot. So my question is for Dr. Fitch. I was part of a team that sold a live streaming distance learning equipment in 2011-2012 to four Ethiopian universities. These were world-class equipment and capabilities that can compete with the likes of Harvard, MIT, Johns Hopkins. But one of the things I wasn't so sure about, which I'm hoping you would confirm for me now, is that, one, this would enable live streaming so that, for example, an expert from the United States would be able to teach classes in Ethiopia. So, for example, a specialist in a certain area without having to travel to Ethiopia could teach classes, number one. But number two, the secondary piece, which I was kind of wondering would probably happen, would have been there are Ethiopian experts, for example, around tropical diseases that can in turn teach American students in various teaching hospitals, you know, certain conditions, certain diseases, and share valuable information. But my question, again, was around, one, has that happened? And number two, would this benefit Ethiopian universities to create some sort of a profit center? Go ahead, please.
I'm going to have to plead ignorant here in terms of the specifics of the broad streaming, that the live streaming activities that you've set up with four universities in Ethiopia. Otto, do you know about this?
No, I don't. Yeah.
I think the concept is excellent. It is often limited, you know, by bandwidth and internet access issues over there. And I believe Gondar, unfortunately, still struggles with those on a regular basis. The family physicians, of course, would be trying to support even more rural areas than Gondar. And I think we will use whatever technology is available to use and probably invest in technology to increase that because it's so important. But it will be dependent upon the actual ability to, you know, have internet access to rural sites. I would really like to know more specifics and perhaps talk further with you to learn precisely what sites have this live streaming. And regarding your last point, I think there's a huge amount that American physicians could learn from Ethiopian physicians, and that would be an excellent exchange.
Correct. Dr. Apti, if I could add one more.
Sure, go ahead.
Sure. So the key I was trying to kind of highlight here is it always seems to be in developing nations that the information exchange is always one way. Expertise is provided from here to there. But it seems like, let me give a case. For example, in India, there's a lot of this back and forth in expertise where teaching hospitals here learn about certain specific diseases that happen in India by partnering with the universities. So, and it's kind of proven to be a pretty good profit center. So I was really hoping that due to funding limitations, and I think this would apply to both the guests today, Ethiopian universities could actually look at how can we create, you know, and get real money by creating curriculum that can also be attractive for certain tie-ups with American universities or European universities. That was really the point I was trying to get clarified.
I think there's no question that people have expertise in the things they do day in and day out and have studied in, and there's a lot of illnesses in that doctors in the U.S. and Europe have little exposure to that they could learn a lot from.
Okay, Dr. Haptik, can I add one more, and then I will zip it?
Okay, all right, go ahead, please.
I don't mean to hog it. I'll be quick. So there was a question around mobile device delivery for health questions. A lot of times now, there's also, we work, for example, with in the Chennai region in India, with regards to when you have conditions that are pretty bad, but to enable mobile devices to even be able to track and act as a capability to have, like, to trigger a first response so that maybe based on a certain condition, a person could, you know, requires to go to the nearest hospital ASAP. But it seems to be like there's been a bit of a low-cost devices that have been placed that can even be beneficial for developing nations. Have you heard of any of that mobile device-based first response anywhere in Africa yet? Any interest in there?
In terms of first response, I mean, in general, the capabilities in Africa are really restricted to, urban centers. Most of the successes I've heard about with mHealth are, you know, getting basic information to more peripheral areas. First response is so affected by roads and transportation and things like that, as well as, you know, the emergency capacity of regional hospitals. So I have not heard of that. It doesn't mean it's not
right.
Ready for the next step, though.
Right. That has always been a challenge, even in the big cities. I mean, there's the first emergency medicine program was just started in Black Lion Hospital, but the emergency and trauma services are they're in their infancy in Ethiopia, even in the big cities. But one venture that was recently started was a program called Hello Doctor, and this is like a call center where people could call in with either questions about their health or even actual specific advice about their conditions. I'm not quite sure how successful it was, but things like that, ventures like that are starting. And as far as, you know, web-based, virtual, and distant education, there have been some efforts, you know, people-to-people have been involved in that. There has been like an ongoing program for years now on infectious diseases and HIV and AIDS that between the Mayo Clinic and Johns Hopkins that is done on a weekly basis with some of the medical facilities in Ethiopia. So there is some activity in there, but there's a lot more that needs to be done. On that note, I want to shift gears here and Dr. Fitch ask you about, we just had the World AIDS Day on December 1st, and I know you worked with USAID and the PEPFAR program and subsequently with the Elizabeth Glaser Foundation in establishing and scaling up HIV services and treatment. What are your thoughts on the status of HIV and AIDS in Africa at this time?
Thank you for asking me that. I have been, privileged to see in Africa an enormous change in 15 years. And most of that is it's from maybe 12 different countries. But I have seen in Rwanda, a country where the majority of its hospitals didn't have running water, electricity, let alone doctors, with the funds from a variety of donors, not only, cut the prevalence of HIV by 50%, but also get water and electricity and physicians in their hospitals and improve overall many aspects of care so that maternal mortality rate went down and children were vaccinated more. So I've seen enormous strengthening of healthcare systems. And specifically about AIDS, in most countries, the prevalence rate has dropped by over 50% in 15 years. And I would think the majority of countries in Africa now have about half of the eligible patients for ART on treatment. And close to over half of pregnant women who are HIV positive getting tested and getting put on prophylaxis or ART for life with option B plus. So I've seen incredible improvements. That said, there is still half of the eligible population not yet on ART, probably not aware of their HIV status and therefore still continuing the epidemic. But it's been absolutely amazing to see the progress that has been made.
Okay, great. And I want to ask both of you whether when you're planning your next trip to Ethiopia and what objectives would you have at that time?
Well, I don't have a next trip planned. We're waiting to our fingers are crossed to see if we can if this funding will come through. If it doesn't come through, then we have to be creative and go back to the drawing board and come up with something else.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then on that vein, you may know that in Ethiopian medical education, residency training is not only optional; it's not always available. So typically a new graduate serves about 2 years or more as a general practitioner before he or she can join a residency program. So do you think going forward, at least conceptually or in your experiences in other African countries, mandatory residency training like in the United States with family medicine among the other option for generalists is the way to go?
It's a question of resources and quality and trying to find the right balance between them. It certainly would, to add 2 or 3 more years of training to every physician, would significantly improve their capacity, but would also cost a lot. So I think it's very important to demonstrate results from this investment. For the Ministry of Health to look at, changing the pay scale of general practitioners all over the country based upon higher training is a big investment, and I'm sure they don't have the money right now. So it's always a political question as well. What is the priority?
I think one of the reasons I was asking this question is because I've heard there was difficulty in recruiting, trainees for residency programs because, after couple of years, they kind of tend to establish themselves where they're at, where the lifestyle has changed. Quite a few of them have started developing their own practice. So that was one of the angles that was being looked at. Do you know or do you anticipate difficulty in recruiting trainees for the family medicine program?
I think it is it's a financial question. I think if family physicians, when they graduate from the program, have secure jobs with higher pay, I think that's a prerequisite to recruiting candidates. If it's not worth their time to do it, then they won't.
Right. Okay.
That's a resource allocation question. So, I would. Part of the job of this program is to work with the ministry to make sure that there's an end result for these graduates from the program.
Okay. All right. Before we wind down, I would like to ask both of you for some closing remarks or final thoughts. If we could start with you, Dr. Koster.
I think... This expansion into family practice medicine, I don't want to be overly optimistic, but I'm really encouraged by the fact that it is being taken on at a very serious level. The Ministry of Health is serious about it. The institutions of higher education are serious about it. And I have to say, I have always felt that in Ethiopia there is a commitment to higher education, to improvement of professional skills, a commitment which I find is really much more encouraging and in many ways stronger than other parts of the developing world. And I think that things are going to go in the right direction.
Okay, thank you. And Dr. Fitch?
Sure. It would be a tremendous honor and opportunity, I think, if we are successful in helping this family medicine program move forward. I'm not an Ethiopia expert, but I am certainly aware of all Ethiopia has done that's impressive to improve its overall the health of the population, what it has done to strengthen its health system in the last 20 years. And I was not really that surprised when I heard that the Minister of Health had directed three universities to expand family medicine program, because I do think that shows the leadership that I've seen come from Ethiopia in the last decade. So I think it's a great opportunity. I think there's a lot of vision and being demonstrated by the ministry here, and I really hope we can move ahead with this. It'd be great.
All right, so this brings us to the conclusion of our program for this evening. I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Nancy Fitch, a family medicine specialist and an expert in primary health service delivery and system strengthening, and Dr. Otto Koster, who is a senior fellow at the Maureen and Mike Mansfield Center at the University of Montana, where he's responsible for program development and grant acquisition related to international education, research, and professional exchange. Thank you both so very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Our pleasure.
And I look forward to a similar opportunity in the future. And I want to thank you, the audience, for tuning in to the Global Health Forum. We invite you to join us every first Thursday of the month at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. As always, you can help shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peoplepeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. Remember, if you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on People to People website. Please check our website for more details on upcoming topics and guests. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapti, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of next month with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Have a happy holiday season and stay engaged.